So, as far as the channels are concerned, you will have heard that you have a variety of different channels to choose from. If you understand English, then English is channel 6, the original. German language will be on channel 4. 5 will be German if it's translated. Otherwise, we have everything as before. So, what we're going to do now for the next 1 hour is we will look at Anuk Adaprakasam's book, The Story of a Brief Marriage. We're going to talk a little after I've introduced the author and the translator. We're going to do this reading in English and in German. So it's going to be a bit of a mix, but that will give you an idea of what is to happen. So here we have our main guest, Anuk Adaprakasam. He was born in 1980. He's born up in Colombo in Sri Lanka. And he grew up with both languages, Tamil and English. Tamil very much the childhood language, English the education and career language. For the last 11 years, he's been living in the United States, where he's studying philosophy. First, he was in California. He spent the last 7 years in New York, though. What is fascinating is when you hear in the United States, he's written his book in English, and you always think, creative writing. But, as I've said, he neither attended any creative writing course nor any literature course. He's a student of philosophy. So literary writing is completely divorced from what he's studying. In this debut novel, The Story of a Brief Marriage deals with one day in a refugee camp in the Sri Lankan Civil War, where two teenagers meet, Dinesh and Ganga. And they meet because Ganga's father is looking for a husband for his daughter, and he simply talks to Dinesh about it. Arranged marriages are not unusual in this culture, so it's one way of going about it. After this pretty simple wedding, father disappears and the two young people have to see how they are supposed to get on with each other. There is a very cautious, initially somewhat uncomfortable way they approach each other, which is very beautiful, very tender and quite moving, as we will hear in one of the passages which will be read. And the backdrop to the whole situation is a continuing war. It's a refugee camp, but it's anything but safe. They're being shot at, there are bombs, there are people injured and killed. I'm not going to tell you all about the novel, don't worry, but I'm going to start with a question to Anuk. When reading, the impression is that you get right into the heart of the figures of these characters you've written, into their very physical experience. This sort of bodily experience we experience is a very extraordinary literary realization you have conveyed. Is that your principle in writing?
I wouldn't say it's my principle in general, but I think it was how I had to approach this book. You were talking about my background. I grew up in very privileged circumstances, very far away from the war. Even though I grew up in Sri Lanka, and Sri Lanka is a small country, you know, it's amazing the disparities that you have in places even as small as Sri Lanka. So I was not affected by any of this. And therefore, the whole project was a project of trying to understand from a distance, from a psychic distance and from a geographic distance, the condition of somebody in such a situation. And, you know, as you were saying, there were bombs falling, there were people dying, 40,000 people according to the UN, 40,000 civilians. It was a very traumatic situation, and to me, I guess, part of what is how I was understanding trauma in this novel was trauma is a condition in which part of which involves the separation of the inner and the outer. So thoughts, feelings, emotions, moods, all of these get lost. They no longer make it to the face, they no longer make it to the voice. They no longer find outer expression. There's a, you know, when you if you talk to somebody who's been traumatized in this severe way, there's this sense that you're not quite seeing what they're talking about. They would talk about what happened, but they would do it in a very monotone voice. as if they are reciting something from a book, or as if they're talking about something that has not happened to them, because there's this separation. And so I guess one of the tasks in writing this book is, how do you write about the mental life of somebody who does not have access to their mental life?
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, and how do you write about somebody also who has gone through experiences that you have not gone through, who you cannot identify with on this level? And so for me, the one commonality between Dinesh and myself is that we both have bodies, and that he has to go through certain kinds of bodily processes, sleep, walking, urinating, defecating, touching, that I have to go through, that everybody has to go through. And so to me, this was in a situation which the mind has been destroyed. This was the only thing I felt that I could, the only way I could enter into such a person.
Mm-hmm. Über die Körperlichkeit, die.
So the physicality, the replaces psychology, because the mind no longer is psychologically present, if you like. Psychology of the body, maybe. And I think that makes the book special, and we will see that when we hear the examples being read from the book, which will truly illustrate that. But of course, now I also want to welcome the second guest, that is Hans Meyer, the translator, born 1982. He lives in Wuppertal together with his family. He studied literary translation from English and French into German in Düsseldorf, and he's already done quite an impressive lot of translations. Now, when you translate something, you've got to get into the sort of narrator and an attitude in order to understand, and then tell the story in German and hopefully achieve an equivalent impact. What was the condition that text put you into? Well, I think despite all the horror, the pain, the violence, this text exudes calm and has a sort of soothing impact on the reader, at least to some extent. And the character Dinesh and the narrator are extremely sort of careful in dealing with things, and the way it's narrated, what Dinesh is doing. And this sort of, on the one hand, the calmness of the language is what I wanted to transport while still remaining lively and alive. Of course, in a war situation, which is the backdrop to this film, that seems almost contradictory, because we always think a war has to be permanent excitement and noise and all of that. I think instead of going on talking about this, let's let the book talk for itself, and let us now listen to a first passage from the book where Dinesh is on his own. And we will now hear how he feels and how he is. And Anuk will start.
Dinesh moved quickly at first through the darkness of the canopy, in spite of being unable to see the ground in front of him. It felt pleasant to use his legs vigorously after having sat down for so long, to feel the pressure in his feet and the strain in his calves as they lifted up the weight of his body with each step. He moved surely and without hesitation along his habitual path, and then as the trees gradually thinned and the darkness let up, he found himself slowing down, not so much from fatigue as from a kind of nervousness about what would happen on his way through the camp. His movement became more tentative, and then finally, at the edge of the jungle, he came to a stop. The sky, immense and empty, opened out over him. The half moon was brightly visible, except for brief interludes in which whorls of translucent cloud passed beneath, and it gave out a soft blue backlight that seemed wholly without source. Stretching out in front of him, each tent in the vast settlement absorbed and reflected this light, like a nighttime gathering of wraiths with nowhere to hide. The dull thudding of artillery and gunfire could be heard in the distance, but the camp itself felt cocooned in silence, as though the fighting that was raging on non-stop to the north, west, and south was a blanket in which the camp was swaddled rather than something that could enter and destroy it at will without warning many times a day. Careful not to disturb the pervasive stillness, Dinesh began walking quietly through the periphery of the camp. Most of the evacuees were inside their tents, together with their families and things, but many were sleeping under the open sky, on the ground and in uncovered trenches, individually and in groups of up to four or five. Observing them as he passed into the more populated sections of the camp, Dinesh found himself filled slowly with the sacredness of being awake in a place in which everybody else was asleep.
Bemüht, die alles durchdringende Stille nicht zu stören, ging Dinesh leise durch den Außenbereich des Lagers. Die meisten Evakuierten waren in ihren Zelten, bei ihren Familien und Sachen, aber viele schliefen auch unter freiem Himmel, auf dem Boden oder in offenen Gräben, einzeln oder in Grüppchen von bis zu 4 oder 5 Personen. Während er diese Menschen ansah und in die belebteren Teile des Lagers vordrang, wurde Dinesh erfüllt von einem Gefühl der Heiligkeit, wach zu sein unter so vielen Schlafenden. Die gerade erst Eingeschlafenen erkannte er leicht an der gerunzelten Stirn und den geschürzten Lippen, an der mühsamen Anstrengung, die Welt auszusperren, die ihnen noch ins Gesicht geschrieben stand. Die Muskeln angespannt, die Augen fest zugekniffen, als wollten sie nichts von außen eindringen lassen, kämpften diese eng zusammengekrümmten Körper um den Schlaf oder gegen das Aufwachen, wofür ihnen das nächste Bombardement die Ruhe nahm. So wie er früher, wenn er morgens zu früh aufgewacht war, sich geweigert hatte, die Augen zu öffnen und stur vorgegeben hatte, noch zu schlafen, obwohl er genau wusste, dass er bald aufstehen und sich wieder der Welt würde stellen müssen. Die Körper derjenigen dagegen, die schon länger schliefen, waren entspannt. Ihre Kiefer waren erschlafft, ihre Gesichter waren friedlich und unangestrengt und zeigten keine Anzeichen eines Abwehrkampfes gegen die Welt mehr. Die meisten hatten ihre Taschen als Kissen unter dem Kopf oder die Arme und Beine darum geschlungen wie um Teddybären. Aber sie krallten sich nicht mehr daran fest und hatten sie oft sogar losgelassen. Ihre unmittelbare Umgebung schien sie nicht mehr zu kümmern. Als hätte sich ihr Blick mehr oder weniger nach innen gerichtet, weg von ihren Augen und Ohren, Händen und Füßen. Die meisten träumten, ihre Lippen zuckten und Augenlider flatterten wie bei Ganga. Ihre Finger und Zehen krümmten und entkrümmten sich, während ihre Besitzer im ungewissen Reich wankender Dinge und obskurer Gefühle schwebten. Zum Teil noch in dieser Welt, aber hauptsächlich außerhalb, während einige anscheinend ganz loslassen konnten. Den Mund geöffnet, die Arme und Beine von sich gestreckt, das Heben und Senken der Brust so schwach, dass man kaum wusste, ob sie überhaupt noch atmeten, hatten sie anscheinend aufgehört zu träumen und sich in einem tieferen, zeitloseren Schlaf verloren. Es war, als hätten diese Schlafenden sich vollständig von der Welt abgekoppelt, nicht nur von ihren Objekten, sondern auch von den Formen, durch die diese Objekte normalerweise wahrgenommen werden. Als wären sie davongegangen und hätten ihre Körper ungeschützt im Lager zurückgelassen, im Vertrauen, dass sie in Sicherheit waren, auch wenn jederzeit Metallsplitter vom Himmel regnen konnten.
It was as though, having relinquished totally the world outside them, these sleepers were in the presence now of something special, of something elusive and beautiful that had appeared or become visible inside them and which completely ensnared them. As when one peers into the bottom of a well that is momentarily unused, in which the movement of water is calmed and even the gentlest ripples on the surface are stilled, and looking down one can see the things that have remained silently unnoticed at the very bottom all the long years of its use. Unable to pull away, one was drawn closer and closer inside. And just as even an insect skating lightly across the water's surface might suffice to call back one's attention from the depths, make one blink and turn away, Dinesh was afraid that even the slightest movement he made might take those people lost deep in sleep away from what they had found.
Während er den schlafenden Menschen des Lagers vorbeiging, fragte sich Dinesh, ob er sich in den letzten Monaten nicht doch mehr Mühe hätte geben sollen, einzuschlafen. Nicht nur, weil er müde war, sondern weil er vielleicht, wenn er nicht schlief, etwas verpasste, was er nie mehr würde erleben können. So viele Jahre hatte er versucht, Schlaf zu vermeiden, ihn als eine von vielen Ablenkungen vom zentralen Lebenszweck abzuwehren, den er zwar nie so recht hatte identifizieren können, auf den er aber dennoch sehnlich wartete und vor dem er hoffte, er würde sich vielleicht irgendwann am Nachthimmel offenbaren. Selbst wenn er müde gewesen war und früh hatte aufstehen müssen, war er immer lange aufgeblieben. So würde er sich dadurch in die Lage bringen, Erfahrungen zu machen, die das Leben ihm vorenthielte, wenn er einschlief. Aber vielleicht war das falsch gewesen. Vielleicht hätte er bereitwilliger einschlafen und empfänglicher für das sein sollen, was der Schlaf bereithielt, was er in diesem Moment den Menschen um ihn herum gab. Denn hasst man nicht jede Störung, wenn man schläft? Ist man nicht immer dazu bereit, für den Rest seines Lebens weiterzuschlafen? Auch jetzt weigerte er sich zu schlafen. So als würde sich, wenn er wach blieb, etwas ereignen, was die lange Anstrengung des Wachbleibens wieder wettmachte. Aber was für eine Belohnung konnte das schon sein? Was konnte es jetzt noch bringen, weiter wach zu bleiben? Er hatte sich waschen wollen, damit Ganga ihn anerkannte. Aber selbst wenn es half, würde er immer noch warten müssen, bis sie aufwachte und es merkte. Also hätte er ebenso gut schlafen und sich stattdessen am Morgen waschen können. Dann hätte er ihr auch Bescheid sagen können, bevor er sie allein ließ. Wenn er wollte, konnte er natürlich immer noch umkehren. Ganga schlief sicher noch ruhig auf der Lichtung und wahrscheinlich hatte mittlerweile auch sie sich im Tiefschlaf verloren. Noch konnte er zurückgehen und neben ihr einschlafen, sich zusammenrollen, die Hände unter den Kopf legen und selbst in diesen tiefen, ahnungslosen Zustand abdriften. All das konnte er haben, wenn er zurückging und sich neben Ganga legte. Aber er war jetzt schon weit genug gekommen und fast am Brunnen angelangt. Es würde gut tun, seinen Körper zu reinigen und auch das Einschlafen würde schöner sein, wenn er sauber war. Fürs Erste wollte er wach bleiben.
Vielen Dank. Dankeschön.
Ja, wir hören. So we hear this, we hear these little details, things that seem everyday to us. You know, you sleep or you don't, where do you sleep, now you go and wash and all these matters. But hearing this makes you understand that in this exceptional situation of a refugee camp at a time of war, they assume a special importance and to some extent replace things that feelings, emotions, psychology might otherwise allow you to simply process or interpret in a different way. And look, when one reads this book, spontaneously, the first thought is, that guy really knows what he's talking about. He has to have experienced this. And then you tell us you haven't actually experienced this. How did you approach this matter? Since, how did you know what you were getting into when writing this and how to empathize? Or what was the material you used?
A number of things. I didn't realize actually that I was going to write a novel. I was just writing scenes actually. The thing that I saw that led me to writing those scenes initially. A number of pictures and videos that started circulating on the internet. Actually, these days. Almost any war, anywhere in the world, you can find an endless trove of very disturbing videos, very disturbing photos spread out on the internet, not on Facebook or Instagram, of course, but in various hidden places. A lot of this material started surfacing in the months after the end of the war, and I came into contact with it. And it had a very visceral effect on me. You know how they say that the light that you watch, that you see around you, the light that comes from the sun comes many, many millions of years after it has actually been emitted. This was the same quality, because I saw these photos, photos of suffering. You could look at the people suffering, all after it was over. So it's a strange feeling to come into contact with such vivid and such visceral suffering when it's all over, when there's silence. Which is why silence is, you know, plays such a, I guess, strong role in this novel, because now there's actually nothing that can be done. And it affected me very viscerally, and I simply started writing, and I didn't know that it was going to be a novel. It only became clear subsequently, I guess. And there was, at some point, there was a decision, okay, shall we spend the next 2.5 years looking at these pictures every day. Not that it was not that it involved suffering on my part, but you know, it was a decision that I had to make. I think, like, deciding what kind of novel to write, if you're a novelist, is deciding what kind of life to live for the next 2 or 3 or 4 years. So at some point I thought, okay, I will do this. It became a little bit more straining as time went by, and at a certain point my sister told me, Anuk, you should stop working on this. You're becoming quite a hateful person. And so I went through it quite quickly. I finished the last 3 or 4 chapters in a few months. And then I put it away. And unfortunately, I still have to come to events like this. but yeah, at some point I decided, and then I just finished. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and you have that.
And you yourself, you said that quiet silence is important, and you said, you know, the voices reached you when it was all over, and the voices are no longer sometimes alive, and certainly not in the present. But the way you narrate the story, at the time it happens, there is still this eerie sort of silence. I mean, Hannah spoke about this calm that the book exudes while you're reading it. Do you think that has to do with the fact that the psychology of the body you mentioned is also silent? Or does silence for you, in the way you perceive the world, something else, something different? That silence seems to be so important in the book, so what's it mean to you?
Okay, this is a difficult question. There are many kinds of silence. There's a silence that follows an argument. There's a silence that follows sex. There's the silence that comes after a party has ended. And in this book also, there are many different kinds of silence. Actually, one name that I was going to give the novel was A Taxonomy of Silences, mm-hmm. because it's a collection of different silences. I would say there's a scene in this book that actually talks about this, but this is just one kind of silence, but it's a kind of silence that's important to me as a writer and in writing this book. And I think it's important in any text that I write. The silence that comes when two people are having a conversation in which each person is truly communicating to the other person. You get the sense slowly that if the conversation is real and therefore it's trying to reach something, it's striving for something, each person makes a move and they get closer and closer and closer. And in a way, the point of such conversations is to capture a mood or capture a feeling. And then when it's been captured, to simply dwell in it. For a conversation to reach a point at which conversation is no longer possible. Wittgenstein, I have to mention a philosopher, I suppose, because I'm a PhD student. he writes a lot about silence, and his first book, the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, he talks about his book. The function of his book is it's like a ladder. It's a ladder that you use to climb up onto another level, and once you reach your destination, you kick away the ladder. The text itself is a ladder, and it has no other function. And I also view conversations often, good conversations, in this way, and I also often view texts in this way. The point of a text is to bring you into a certain kind of mood or into a certain kind of way of being that once you have achieved, you simply dwell in it. Everybody knows the feeling when you have finished a book, you mm-hmm. put it down, and you don't want to talk to anybody for at least a little bit. In this case, the silence and the mood was a mood of, I think, a certain form of being present, mm-hmm. a certain form of being attentive to the present. And so this is why in various ways nothing happens really in the text. Mm-hmm. Or a thing happens and then they simply dwell. I don't know if this answers your question.
Well, I mean, any answer, jede Antwort, die du...
Ultimately, any answer you give me is always the right answer, because I wanted to know what you think. But it's absolutely exciting to see how very present silence and quiet are in this book. That's why I was so fascinated by it. Even if you later write about other subjects, we will find this silence again, because I think that may well be the style that also characterizes you. One other question that I'm interested in. You said that Tamil is the language of your childhood, while English is the sort of educational language. Do you intend to write in Tamil? And if so, what will it be? A children's book?
Yes, I do. I do. I wasn't educated formally in Tamil, only for 1 year. And so in the last 10 years or so, I've been educating myself. Because the spoken form of Tamil is quite different from the written form, so it's not something you can move from one to the other very easily. Children's books. Okay.
Das war vielleicht ein Scherz wegen
Kindern. Or maybe that was a bit of a joke.
An answer. So I write in English, or this book was published in English. And as you know, one of the things about the English language is that it has taken over all countries, all languages, and all communities, and the ones that it hasn't taken over, it's slowly in the process of taking over. I mean, it won't last forever. Every language has its downfall. I don't know if we'll get to live to see the downfall of English, but I'm hoping that we will. And when a language is so spread out, you don't know who you're reading to. Now, say if I write in Tamil, there are many different kinds of Tamils. People who agree with me, people who disagree with me, people with political opinions that I share, those that I don't, people from different castes, people from different religious groups. But because they speak the Tamil language, they have a certain connection to a certain piece of land in South India and northern eastern Sri Lanka, and they have a connection to a certain history, to certain music, to certain song. And what this means is that even if I am not in agreement, or if I'm very different, I could be very different, you know. I've lived in New York for 7 years. I'm very, very different from most Tamils in Sri Lanka. There's some shared history and shared culture, which means I, in a way, I know who I'm talking to. Mm-hmm. Now, with English, you don't have this. When you write in English, you know, anybody could be paying attention. And the thing is, if you think about the things you're willing to say or the things you're willing to share, you don't share it with anybody. Mm-hmm. You don't go up to the person who works at the grocery store and, you know, tell them intimate things about your life. No, you say it to certain people in certain situations. And when you write in English, you don't have this control. You don't have this intimacy. And this is one reason I would never write nonfiction in English. Mm-hmm. Because I don't want to show myself to all of these clowns who are reading and writing in English all over the world, who I don't have anything in common with. So I think when I start to write in Tamil, I will be able to write in a mode that is more confessional, mm-hmm. and I share more of myself. Mm-hmm. I think, yeah.
Du bist der erste Schriftsteller.
You're the first writer who willingly wants to restrict his audience. I think that's amazing. Now, let us look at the translation. Hannes, you've already said that in this text, the language of this author lives on the basis of this sort of sentences that seem to be floating without any gravity. English is capable of doing that, but German not so easily. How did you approach the syntax? Yes, in English you have all these participles and different types of construction. I mean, thinking this, he did, blah, blah, blah. So rather different. And you can put a whole subclause into just one little word. And that way, as authors do, they can have long, drawn-out, but yet elegant sentences. And this type of grammatical language, being, doing, and so on, is rather horrid in German. So you've got to sort of go into this and unravel the sentence and build it into lots of little sentences, which still aren't nice. So at some stage, you've got to, you know, understand the sentence, explain it, and then all the bits that you've unraveled have to be put together into an elegant whole again. I've got one example here, something from the second part, the section which we'll be reading in a moment. That is one very long sentence which I took, and first I did a raw translation, looking at, you know, the very long sentence before I, you know, beautified it and streamlined it. And I read it in German.
Sagen, wenn sie ihn für fragil oder versehrt hielt. Es war nicht angenehm, aber er hatte keine Wahl. Doch was er nicht ertragen konnte, war, ihr in die Augen sehen zu müssen, während sie gerade bei solchen Gedanken verweilte. In der Art vielleicht, dass man, wenn man jemand die Tür ohne Vorwarnung aufreißt, während man sich umzieht, feststellt, dass es unmöglich ist, der Person in jenem Moment, obwohl man mit ihrer direkten Gegenwart konfrontiert ist, in die Augen zu sehen.
So, das ist alle mitgekommen? Ein langer Original.
This is a very long original sentence. All of that is one sentence. I think anybody who's ever translated anything is now laughing because they share your feeling. And obviously what you've done is not grammatically wrong German, but it's far removed from the original elegant English sentence. Now I'm giving you the proper version I ended up with, which is streamlined and you know, beautified.
Wenn sie ihn für angreifbar oder versehrt hielt, konnte er das einigermaßen ertragen. Das wäre zwar nicht angenehm, aber wohl unvermeidlich. Doch er konnte ihr einfach nicht in dem Moment in die Augen sehen, als sie über solche Dinge nachdachte. So wie man vielleicht einer Person nicht in die Augen sehen kann, die ohne Vorwarnung ins Zimmer kommt, während man sich gerade umzieht, auch wenn man unmittelbar mit ihrer Gegenwart konfrontiert ist.
Ich finde das genau.
I think, wow, yes. A round of applause for you. This tiny little insight into how you can use the German language and what it has available to try and mirror what is written in English. And I think this illustrated what probably was the problem you had to face with every single sentence in this book. But how much of what you're doing is sort of linguistic experience or hand craftsmanship, if you like, and how much is analysis, intellectual analysis? How do you do that, guts or brains? Well, with me, it's mainly, I mean, a lot of it's sort of craftsmanship. I mean, automatically you do much that is sort of crafting things. Obviously, you'll have to cut things out and put things together, and perfectionist a bit is what I am. But basically, the first version is one I'm pretty happy with, but I'm not an editor. I mean, you always get sub-editors changing things. But of course, it is also clear not everything that you've changed here from your version 1 to your version 2 are only grammatically related. There are sometimes semantic decisions which word to use to make the book a German language novel. I think it's very interesting to take the time to show very briefly what translation means. You write like the author, but you use the tools in your own language to do so. We were able to get a brief glimpse of what this is like. Now, in this passage which you just read, there were two different times in it. The narration, i.e. the past, in which everything is said, but then suddenly it jumps into the present. Why? Well, in this text and in the book, I think, there are sort of truths which go beyond time constraints. Well, the English language can express all of that in the present, but it's different from German. In German, we're much stricter in the grammatical structure on that. Could you read this sentence?
When you were asleep, you always hated disturbances after all. When you were asleep, you're always happy to stay that way for the rest of your life.
Genau, das habe ich dann eben.
And that's I put into the present in German. You see, things like this, which are very general statements, and in German I tend to put them into the present tense rather than into another tense. But there are other passages in the book which express very similar things, but where it's actually focuses on the fact that Dinesh is experiencing these thoughts, and you have to look at this. It's not a sort of maths thing where you say, this is like this, so I'll put it like that. You have to weigh the pros and cons. So that was a second glimpse into the challenges posed by such a text. Any text, of course, but this particular text also very much. Before we come to an end, I would like to hear one more passage read by both of you in the two different languages, where the two main characters, Dinesh and Ganga, actually are together, where they've met. The father has already introduced them to each other, and they have overcome the first sort of strangeness at meeting, and now they are together and beginning to slowly realise that they're going to spend the rest of their lives, or the next foreseeable time, as long as they're married, they're going to spend that time together. And they're beginning to understand what it means. So let's start that.
Where do you go during the shelling? Do you stay here? No. He shook his head and motioned east. There's an upside-down boat about 5 minutes from here. Some fisherman must have dragged it into the jungle instead of leaving it by the shore. Usually I crawl inside that. It's quite big. Both of us can definitely fit inside. Is it strong enough to guard against the shrapnel? Yes, the wood is very thick. Shrapnel is less of a problem in the jungle anyway because of all the trees. But if you want, we can dig a trench beneath it tomorrow just in case. We can think about it tomorrow. Maybe it would be for the best. I can do it by myself in the morning. It won't be difficult. Ganga nodded her head in acquiescence, as if the suggestion was acceptable to her or even pleasing. She drew back a few strands of hair that had fallen over her face, and then tucked her hands back under her thighs. There was a looseness in the way she moved her body that made her seem more comfortable than earlier in the day, more relaxed, less on guard. Dinesh too felt more at ease, no longer worried about whether they had to resume their marriage from scratch. It was as though, in the brief period of time in which they had been separated from each other, they had actually grown closer to each other, more understanding or more aware of each other. Maybe some deep inner affinity between them was being uncovered, Maybe their new comfort was a sign of some more ancient understanding that had always existed between them. Though probably not, Dinesh knew, for however pleasing these possibilities might have been to consider, the actual explanation was probably more mundane. Even in normal life, after all, the second meeting with a new person was always much easier than the first, the third easier than the second, and so on, even if nothing concrete changed between these meetings. It was in the time between meetings that each body came to terms with all the newness and strangeness of another body, after all, to its smell and presence and speech and manner. It was in the periods of separation that the muscles and nerves of each person were molded and tuned in response to the other, so that when the two bodies met again, there was, suddenly, much less awkwardness or difficulty. When it came to getting to know a person, the periods of time spent apart were just as important as the periods spent together, and probably that was why things were easier now between them, not because they were in some way meant or destined for one another. There was silence except for the soft back and forth of their breathing, Ganga's light and regular, Dinesh's heavy and a little faster. The rhythms of their rising and falling chests accompanied each other, softly in parallel, intersecting occasionally when they fell out of phase and gradually drawing back together. Dinesh wiped away the tiny drops of sweat that had formed across his forehead and drew his hand back across his hair, still cool and wet from bathing. Even if they'd only gotten more used to each other, even if their new ease around each other was unremarkable, even predictable, still he couldn't help feeling hopeful that it could be a conduit through which something further and more intimate might pass between them. Dinesh shifted his body a little closer to Ganga and tilted towards her so that they were separated by no more than a foot. "Do you work in the clinic every day?" Ganga glanced at him and looked back down. "On most days, whenever I can." "I've seen you there once or twice. I've gone to help a few times too, but only immediately after the shelling, to help move the wounded. I can't imagine working in the clinic every single day. It must be difficult, no, with all the blood and everything? You must be a selfless person." Ganga pulled her hands out from under her thighs and clasped them once more neatly over her lap. "I only go there for my own sake," she said without looking up. "It's good to have something to do, whatever it is. It's better than having to wait." "You go there to be distracted?" Ganga opened her mouth to say something, then stopped.
"Du gehst dahin, um dich abzulenken?" Ganga öffnete den Mund, sagte dann aber doch nichts. Dinesh wartete, aber sie legte nur den Kopf auf die Seite und schaute sich weiter ihre Hände an. Nicht etwa, als hätte sie seine Frage nicht gehört, sondern eher, als wäre sie gar keine Frage gewesen oder als wäre ihr Schweigen schon Antwort genug. Ihre Lippen blieben eine Weile geöffnet, bis sie sich dann doch schlossen und sie sich nach rechts beugte, eins der Steinchen von der Bettumrandung aufhob und es geräuschlos auf der Handfläche herumrollte. Dinesh verspürte den Drang, etwas zu sagen. Er wollte auf ihre Stille reagieren, sie akzeptieren und alles anerkennen, was sie enthielt, aber es schien unangemessen, sie mit Worten zu unterbrechen. Natürlich hatte es auch vorher schon Stille zwischen ihnen gegeben, als sie nach der Heiratszeremonie wie gelähmt dagestanden und als sie zum ersten Mal auf der Lichtung nebeneinander gesessen hatten. Und dann später, als sie im Lager gemeinsam gegessen hatten, doch diese Stille kam ihm irgendwie anders vor. Die vorherige Stille war die zwischen zwei Menschen in verschiedenen Welten gewesen. Dieselbe Stille, wie sie zwischen allen Menschen im Lager herrschte. Eine Stille zwischen zwei Menschen, die durch eine Wand aus glattpoliertem Stein voneinander getrennt waren. Die jetzige Stille dagegen war eine, die sie verband und nicht trennte. Eine Stille, die die Luft zwischen ihnen auflud, sodass sie beide die kleinste Bewegung des anderen sofort spürten und ihre Körper gemeinsam in einem Bereich außerhalb der Zeit gehalten wurden. Über ihnen hellte sich der Himmel auf, als der Mond wieder hinter einer schweren Wolkenmasse hervorkam. Und alles, was eben noch in Dunkelheit gehüllt war, wurde nun erleuchtet. Schwach schimmerte der blau-purpurfarbene Stoff des Saris unter ihnen. Und vor ihnen wurden die dunklen Grüntöne der Fahne und das Grau und Braun der Bäume sichtbar. "Ich gehe da auch deshalb hin", sagte Dinesh leise. Selbst wenn man mit niemandem redet, tut es gut, ab und zu mal unter Menschen zu kommen und sich zu bewegen. Gangas Gesichtsausdruck änderte sich nicht, aber sie hörte auf, mit dem Steinchen zu spielen, das jetzt auf der Mitte ihrer Handfläche lag. Sie starrte es eine Weile an und legte es dann wieder an seinen Platz. Sie schaute Dinesh an und nickte in Richtung des Zierrandes. "War das schon hier?" "Was?" "Lagen die Steine schon so da, als du zum ersten Mal hier warst?" Er schüttelte den Kopf. "Die habe ich da selber hingelegt, als Umrandung. Auf die Idee bin ich gekommen, als ich die Steine aus dem Boden gesammelt habe." Ganga zeigte auf den Hügel am Kopfende. "Hast du den auch gemacht?" Er nickte. "Ich habe die Erde zusammengeschoben. als Kissen. Komisch, dass du dir so eine Mühe mit dem Schlafplatz gegeben hast, wo du doch selber gar nicht schlafen kannst. Dinesh schaute kurz Ganga an und dann hoch in die Bäume, am Rand der Lichtung. Wolken zogen vor dem Mond vorbei und der Himmel verdunkelte sich. Die Bäume und Sträucher um sie herum nahmen wieder ihre kaum unterscheidbaren Schwarz- und Dunkelblauschattierungen an. Es war wieder still bis auf ihre Atemgeräusche, deren Frequenz sich etwas angeglichen hatte. Ihr Atem war ein kleines bisschen schneller, ein bisschen schwerer geworden, seiner eine Idee langsamer und ruhiger. Über ihren Köpfen summte leise ein Moskito vorbei und verschwand wieder in der Dunkelheit. Warum kannst du nicht einschlafen? Dinesh schaute Ganga kurz an, die ihn forschend musterte, dann wandte er den Blick schnell in die Bäume. Ich weiß nicht. Ich lege mich hin, mache die Augen zu, kann aber aus irgendeinem Grund nicht schlafen. Gar nicht? Dinesh spürte Gangas fragenden Blick auf sich ruhen, starrte aber weiter in die Dunkelheit vor sich. Es war nicht so, dass er Angst hatte, Ganga könnte ihm ansehen, wie sehr ihn die letzten Monate mitgenommen hatten, denn das hatte sie sicher schon aus seiner Schlaflosigkeit und dem Ausdruck von Scham in seinem Gesicht geschlossen. Wenn sie ihn für angreifbar oder versehrt hielt, konnte er das einigermaßen ertragen. Das wäre zwar nicht angenehm, aber wohl unvermeidlich. Doch er konnte ihr einfach nicht in dem Moment in die Augen sehen, als sie über solche Dinge nachdachte. So wie man vielleicht einer Person nicht in die Augen sehen kann, die ohne Vorwarnung ins Zimmer kommt, während man sich gerade umzieht, auch wenn man unmittelbar mit ihrer Gegenwart konfrontiert ist. Wenn man in einem solchen Moment Blickkontakt herstellt, sieht man sich unwillkürlich durch die Augen des anderen und wird mit Dingen konfrontiert, deren man sich schämt, die man bisher vor sich selbst verbergen oder die man ignorieren konnte. Und deshalb war es in diesen Situationen so wichtig, die Augen abzuwenden, noch bevor man seine Blöße bedeckte. Dinesh senkte den Kopf und richtete den Blick auf seinen Schoß. Nein, erwiderte er leise.
Vielen Dank.
Thank you very much. Thank you. You have now all received an impression of the story of a brief marriage and how it works as a text. Don't miss reading the whole book, because honestly, this story of a whole day describes a situation where you will all become almost tangibly aware what this sort of situation can mean. I've read a lot of books in my life, also some books about war, but I honestly haven't read a single one yet which has made war so immediately come alive, and that's really special. It's not the book you would see every day, so read this story written by Anouk here.